So good to be here today, and I'm so thankful to be able to share another message with you all. And I must admit with you that I kind of shamefully have an addiction to a particular TV show, and it's a reality TV show called Life Below Zero. And for you all that do not know about this TV show, it takes place in the remote parts of Alaska, where conditions are extremely unbearable at times. It can get down to the negative 60s, and the neighbors isn't an ideal situation for a lot of these characters that are in the show. Some neighbors are even 300 miles away. So it is a place of solitude, and what the film crew does is they follow these families and individuals around, and they try to document lifestyle that they have, the way that they live off the land, the way that they survive and live in solitude. And there's a specific character named Glenn, and he probably lives the most primitive lifestyle out of all the characters on the show. And because of the show, he became famous and popular, and a lot of people wanted to talk to him and speak with him and try to get into his psyche and what makes him tick. And recently he was on a popular podcast, and I heard this episode. And one of the first questions was from the interviewer was, how do you get by? How do you survive by yourself? And I should give you the location. This took place in Los Angeles, so they flew him in from the remote parts of Alaska. And he said, "Well, what do you think about Los Angeles?" And I remember him giving this really thought-provoking, thoughtful answer, and he said, "I expected to make connections, and I see people who should be connected with others, and they're trying to disconnect. And I live in a small little cabin in the middle of nowhere, and I find myself to be connected more than ever." And that stuck with me, and I think we find that same type of solitude, that same type of language in this story with Zachariah and Elizabeth. And Glenn goes on to even share more about solitude. He says some interesting things. He says that in solitude, it's a place that he finds transformation. He finds a way that he can't experience anywhere else. It's a place of great struggle, but it's also a place of great encounter. The Gospel of Luke doesn't begin like the Gospel of Mark with Jesus's adult ministry. It doesn't begin with a grand genealogy like the Gospel of Matthew. It begins with a strange, unusual story about an elderly couple. As you heard, wonderfully read this morning, Luke, the author, wastes no time to get into the story and build up the characters and paint a picture for us. And we're told that Zechariah was a priest. In the order that he was in, it was the eighth of 24 divisions of Levites. And each of these divisions served the Jerusalem temple twice annually. And we're also told about Elizabeth, and she was a descendant of Aaron, Moses' brother. And Aaron was the founder of the Israelite priesthood. So up front, we know that these two people, this couple, is deeply connected to priesthood. They live a pious way of life. And in fact, we're told that they're upright, they're righteous, they're good people, faithful Jews. And then the story goes on to tell us about Elizabeth. And we're told that she was barren, and she was getting on in her years. Now, this isn't necessarily a new story. In the scriptures, this has happened before. We can hear the echoes of Abraham and Sarah, Rachel, the births of Samson and Samuel. The echoes of the Old Testament call us to remember what God has done in the past and what God might be doing here in the story. Next, Luke tells us that Zechariah was randomly selected to enter the sanctuary and offer incense. This was a special privilege and an honor for a priest. Some priests would wait a lifetime for this opportunity, a lifetime of waiting to hear their name called. For many, there was nothing. Perhaps this is a nod to the life of Zechariah and Elizabeth, a couple waiting to hear something. Now, it's at this time that the incense and offering had started, and everyone began praying outside, and it was the moment this moment that the angel appeared to Zechariah. And I find it interesting that it's this place, a holy place. This is where the angel appears. Zechariah had probably prayed many, many times, but it was here at the temple, a sacred place, a place where God was thought to dwell, a quiet place, a place where it was just Zechariah. Of course, like many who encounter angels, Zechariah was terrified. And the angel says, "Your prayer has been heard, and you will have a son named John." And the angel goes on to say, "You will have joy and gladness and rejoice at his birth, and he must never have wine or strong drink." Here the angel is essentially indicting John's priestly status. Since John will live a special life, he will play a special role, he will have to live a special life, a priestly life, one like Samson and Samuel. The angel makes a lot of promises to Zechariah. 5 total promises. For such a priestly household, Zechariah and Elizabeth, this is certainly the son that they must want. But perhaps this promise is more than they could ever envision, a blessing they could never fathom. The angel then goes on to explain how John's going to do all of this. But Zechariah asks the angel, "How will I know?" I have a couple different versions of how he asks that question in my head. And of course he asks this question. He says, "I'm old, my wife's old. We've been down this road before. We know the answer to this question." And I suppose the expected reaction here should be one that Zechariah gets up, leaps with joy. But that's not what we find. Instead, Zechariah responds like someone who is guarded, someone who's been let down many times, someone who is perhaps suspicious, untrusting, maybe even doubtful. In a fairy tale, Zechariah would have jumped for joy. But this isn't a fairy tale. This is too real. It's a question that I sense is forged from years and years of disappointment, grief, doubt. The angel replies with authority and says, "I am Gabriel. And because you did not believe my words, you will become mute, unable to speak until the days that these things occur." This is, I admit, a certainly unusual part of the story, and here's where I have landed in trying to understand this. For me, this is how I understand Gabriel. You can trust my words. These are God's words. And I know that this is difficult for you, so I want you to hold these words. Hold these promises. Hold these things close to you. Hold these things so that you can see they are true. I don't see this encounter as punishment, but perhaps a blessing. Another part of me asks, I wonder if Zechariah would have even told Elizabeth anyways. Could he have told Elizabeth that anything that sounded believable? Would have this been trustworthy? Could this have damaged their own relationship? Luke quickly moves us on and reminds us that something else is going on. People are waiting for Zechariah to come out, and they are becoming curious. What's the holdup? As Zechariah exited and came out to the people, he couldn't speak, and they realized that he had seen a vision. He kept motioning to them, but he remained unable to speak. What happens next is vague, but we're told when his service was finished, he went home. And after going home in the following days, in Zechariah's silence, Elizabeth conceived. And for 5 months, she remained in seclusion. But unlike Zechariah, this is self-imposed silence. How ironic. I mean, for years, they have both experienced silence. But for the very moment that their world of silence could have ended, they become mute and secluded. The story ends with Elizabeth acknowledging what God has done. We only get one line from Elizabeth, but it's so interesting. It's so good. Elizabeth's reaction and response is fascinating because it could have been anything. She could have said, "It's about time." She could have remained bitter. Why now? Why not when I was younger? She could have rubbed it in the faces of the community that shamed her. So many possibilities. But she went silent. Something else that fascinates me about Elizabeth's response in reaction is that she was once shamed and excluded from a community. And she can now finally be included into that community, but she chooses not to be. It seems to me that Elizabeth, too, while in the midst of great expectation, turns to silence. In Elizabeth's one line, we see both grief and awe. Perhaps when grief meets awe, we get silence. Maybe when broken hearts hear big promises, silence is appropriate. Silence leaves space and time for the work and the words to sit in. I've never shared this story in public before, but in the spring of 2016, my dad went into the hospital for a routine gallbladder surgery, and there ended up being some complications from the surgery, and he got sepsis, and there was complications after complications, and he ended up being in the hospital for 60 days and before he was finally made it home. And 30 of those days, he spent his time in the ICU. And for those who know the ICU, your time reference world way of life changes. You no longer live in that world. It's an hour-by-hour basis. There's news constantly coming in. There's you want answers. There's the cycle of hope and disappointment. And 60 days is a long time to be in the hospital. It's not a lifetime like Zechariah and Elizabeth, but it felt like forever. And during that time, you kind of feel like a resident at the hospital. You learn the lay of the land. You learn the hallways, which elevators to avoid, the fastest way to the cafeteria, how to get the best parking spots in the parking garage and all that stuff. But you also learn where you can be alone. You learn the quiet places. And it was during that time that I had great expectations, but I felt hopeless, alone, a lot of disappointment. But it was in silence that I felt the presence of God the most. It was there that I could let go. I didn't need answers in those moments. And it's the more that I think about it, it's almost counterintuitive. I think silence is often interpreted as a closed posture, but I think it's an open one. Like Zechariah and Elizabeth, I think we're all recipients of big promises. In this Christmas season, we hear all sorts of promises. Promises of love, hope, peace. Promises of wholeness, inclusion, salvation, light prevailing over darkness, world-changing promises, even promises that'll change our own personal worlds. There's certainly a place for noise, a time for lament. But today in this Advent season, a season that is preparing us for the silent night, let us hear the story of Zechariah and Elizabeth. Let us claim silence in this season. Because in silence, God is there and God is with us.